Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Last night, after winning the California primary, Hillary Clinton marked a moment in history.
We've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
Now, here in Washington State, it was Bernie Sanders who won our Democratic caucuses. So we want to know, what do you think about Hillary as the Democratic nominee?
This is Nancy from Seattle. And for Hillary Clinton as president, all I have to say is thank God, finally.
Hi, this is Ava from Seattle. I'm very disappointed to hear the announcement that Hillary Clinton had enough delegates to secure the nomination and will be our Democratic general election candidate, because the superdelegates do not vote until the convention in July, which means we have 6 weeks until we're going to know who our Democratic candidate will be.
Yeah, Dale Johnson calling from Smoky Port, Arlington. I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary here. I'm going to vote for Trump. I could never vote for Hillary. She has way too much corrupt baggage.
Hi, my name is Brenda Howell, and I'm calling from West Seattle. And the Hillary Clinton of 30 years ago would have had my full 100% excited, engaged support. The Hillary Clinton of 2016 does not. I will vote for her only because I would never vote for a Republican, and I would certainly never vote for this idiot that the Republicans are promoting.
Hello, Jim McBride, Carnation, Washington. I support Hillary, but I know and knew that Bernie, to whom I have sent money, because I recognize that he has been the perfect stalking horse for Hillary, would be the person who would turn her in the minds of people who cannot remember 12 years ago. I'm 76. I do that. She is really a warrior and not a cream puff, and that has been the benefit of their exchange, and I support Hillary. She has been made Bennett better because of that circumstance.
What are your thoughts about this presidential election? Give us a call here at KUOW. We're at 206-221-3663. What's your take? 206-221-3663. You can email us, record@kuow.org. In the news today, the best high school football team in the state has been slapped with some heavy penalties. An investigation found that the Bellevue High School football program had broken the rules, students giving false addresses, players sent to a private school, improper recruiting. Yesterday, the King County Football Conference handed down sanctions that will prevent the school from making the playoffs for 4 years. That means the Bellevue Wolverines won't even be eligible to be state champs or any place close. Well, that makes Dale Echigoshima sick to his stomach. Dale's son is a ninth grader at Bellevue High, a member of the football team. Dale says this punishment hurts innocent kids.
You're basically, you know, giving the death penalty to the football program, and you're saying that even, you know, kids that are in eighth grade that haven't even, you know, gotten to Bellevue High yet, you're basically saying, you know, your football career at Bellevue High is over before you've even started. They can still play conference, you know, league games, but honestly, until you get to deep into the playoffs, a lot of games really aren't that competitive. And I know everybody, you know, points at Bellevue as saying, well, they win all the time because they cheat. They win all the time because they recruit. But that's not the case. But there's a lot of animosity about Bellevue winning. It's just sad that, you know, they're taking it out on the program and just trying to crush the dreams of all the kids that, you know, are part of Bellevue football.
Well, Dale, there are undoubtedly many reasons why the Bellevue Wolverines have been so great for so long. But this investigation found a lot of rule breaking, fake addresses, sending players to this private school, improper payments to the coach, on and on. Why should the football program? First of all, do you accept the findings that Bellevue did break the rules in this way?
Bill, there's a difference between allegations and evidence. And they have a 68-page report, the WIAA report, and they have allegations and they have exhibits. They don't have evidence. And if it was evidence, that would be something that was actionable by Bellevue School District. Bellevue School District found that there was no evidence connecting the dots between those seven allegations and any athletic sanctions.
Okay. So are you saying you think that Bellevue High competed on a completely level playing field, no rule breaking, no kids coming in and, you know, who didn't really live there, faking addresses, getting help that you really don't feel good about? You know, you just think none of that went on, or no more than any other school?
I don't believe Bellevue broke any rules. If there were false addresses given, that was done by the individual student, and they should be dealt with on an individual basis. That's not on, you know, the coach. How can that be? No, there was no illegal recruiting. People are drawn to success. People want to move there. And if a kid wants to move into Bellevue School District and go to Bellevue High, which is a fantastic school academically, fantastic school for football, if the parents choose to move there, make the commitment to either buy or rent a house or an apartment so their son can go there and play football, then, hey, this is a free country, you know, and if people have a problem with that, that, so be it.
You say that the kids shouldn't be punished for this. Will you give us, let us know why it matters so much to your ninth grader, to these kids, to be part of a program that can play for the championship and play out of state and play out of district?
Really? It's not apparent? Taking away any postseason play to where they can play for, you know, anything meaningful, championship. If you can't play for the championship, you know, basically, why don't you just go out on Saturdays and, you know, play some rec ball and, you know, call it good, because there's no reward for winning.
That is Dale Echigoshima. His son is a ninth grader at Bellevue High, a member of the football team. Echigoshima wants to see those sanctions overturned and the team's coaches reinstated. The Bellevue School District says it will appeal the sanctions. We'll follow that for you here on KUOW, Seattle. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. When a major earthquake hits the Puget Sound area, I did not say if, when it happens, Lieutenant Colonel Clayton Braun says we could become immobilized.
So many bridges drop that people become isolated within their own communities. It becomes a difficult time to even move around in your own community. Of course, the power's out everywhere and for a very long time. To paraphrase one of our coworkers here, it's kind of like being thrust back into about 1850, and now you're stuck in the Old West. All of the infrastructure stops working. There's no communication. There may not be running water. The ability to handle sewage is gone. Your medical capability is extremely overwhelmed. It becomes a very bad scenario, quite honestly.
Clayton Braun is a member of the Washington State National Guard, and he's part of something called Cascadia Rising, a four-day exercise to test the emergency response to a 9.0 magnitude earthquake along the Cascadia subduction zone. KUOW's Matt Martin went out and asked some of you, how prepared are you for the big one?
It comes across my mind every once in a while. Living in Seattle, you know, the threat of all kinds of natural disasters is constantly looming, but I would regrettably say not enough to actually do something about it.
Like pasta and things like that, but nothing, like I said, specifically for earthquakes.
Yeah, do you feel like you're prepared or ready if some major earthquake or something struck?
No.
No?
No. Okay. I'd be in trouble.
It's honestly the last thing I think about. I haven't taken any steps to prepare myself for it, so I would say probably on the less prepared side.
I don't think I'd have the food to last a couple days. I don't even know. Like, if transportation was down, how would I get to my family? I'd say I'm not prepared.
Okay, so Chris Malcolm, Justin Downs, Zoe Fernio, and Nathaniel Solis do not feel prepared, but Tom Martin does. He's a Northwest-based truck driver and a prepper. And if you've never heard that term before, prepper, it's somebody who stores away months' worth of food, water, often ammo, for when everything falls apart. Martin told me he was inspired to be a prepper when he was driving his truck around and seeing how easily our supply chain could break down.
You know, we have this just-in-time freight that we deliver to the stores, and if you're a truck delivering food to a store, that food's getting put on the shelf that same day. And it cycles like that every single day. And so if the trucks were shut down, the stores would be cleaned out in a matter of hours. People aren't going to have the food stored up like they should have because they haven't been prepared.
And in the Seattle area, we're dealing with a lot of key bridges that could go down, say, in an earthquake.
Oh, yeah. If there was an earthquake and some bridges went down, it's going to shut trucks down for a long time, especially with the chaos going on and people trying to make phone calls and people trying to get out and emergency responders trying to get in. The roads are going to be jammed up and the trucks aren't going to be coming in. And so if that's a major, major disaster, people might be without that supplies and that food for days or weeks.
This is what people are preparing for this week. If a major earthquake hits this region, how do you think you'll respond?
Well, I think if a major earthquake hits, first of all, everybody needs a 72-hour kit because we've noticed from, the hurricanes in Katrina that people weren't prepared for that disaster, and that ties up the emergency responders. So imagine if an earthquake hit in Seattle and most people are not prepared, you have all these able-bodied people that otherwise could have been prepared now won't be prepared, and they're going to be absorbing all the resources of the first responders that are trying to rescue them. And I think that's wrong. I think the first responders should have their attention focused 100% on the people who can't take care of themselves, people that are in, retirement homes and disabled and the elderly. I think that should be their focus on rescuing those people rather than rescuing people that could have and should have been prepared. They could easily evacuate themselves if they needed to.
So you're telling our listeners this isn't just a matter of survival. This is a matter of taking responsibility and freeing up help for other people.
Exactly. And you talk to any first responder that's ever been in a major disaster, they're going to tell you that they've had to help so many people that should have been already ready and able to take care of themselves, and they just weren't because they weren't prepared.
Who else knows that you are prepped? Because I'm wondering if you're going to be this target, this focal point of people wanting help.
That's the whole point about trying to get everybody prepared. If everybody's prepared, then that's not a worry anymore.
Okay.
If everybody's prepared, why do you need to be a target? Because everybody else would have what they need as well.
Right. You want people to be as prepped as you are.
A lot of people say, well, those preppers are so paranoid. And I say, no, quite the opposite. We have a peace of mind that most other people don't have.
You hear that from people you know? They think you're overreacting?
Well, I think it's just common sense. Our parent, our grandparents and our great-grandparents did this during World War II and during the Great Depression. They grew their own food and canned their own food, so this isn't a new concept. The new concept is the normalcy bias and the laziness that people have to not take care of themselves nowadays. That's the new concept, and we're trying to bring things back to common sense like our grandparents and great-grandparents had.
Okay, finally, Tom, what do you recommend for us? I'm listening. You've got me interested. What should I be doing in case of an earthquake or some other big disaster?
It's common sense, just like putting on a seatbelt or having a fire extinguisher in your home. Everyone should have, starting out today, everyone should have a 72-hour kit. Once you've reached that goal, then start thinking about a 3-week supply. And then once you reach that goal, think about a 3-month supply, with the ultimate goal of eventually having a year supply.
Tom Martin is a founding member of the American Preppers Network. So what would be in a 72-hour emergency kit? What would you need for 3 days? Well, the federal government puts out a handy emergency supply list at FEMA.gov, and we are tweeting out a link to that right now. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Are Seattleites complacent in the face of hatred and bigotry? Yesterday on this show, two African-American college administrators, Yoshiko Hardin and Bob Hughes, told us they were sitting in a Seattle Starbucks when a man spit on them and repeatedly yelled racist and sexist insults, and virtually no one in that store offered help or even said a word about it. I asked Bob Hughes, in a situation like that, what do you want a bystander to do?
Come and ask me if I'm okay. Don't ignore me. Don't look away. Don't pretend that nothing happened when something really did. We have a, you know, the Seattle nice culture that we talk a lot about and we laugh about it. But underlying that are some really deep truths about who we are as a community in terms of being engaged with people who are different than us. We're more segregated today than we have been as segregated today as we have been in this city's history. I mean, look at our schools. Look at our communities. Who lives where? You know, all of that has significant impacts on how we interact with each other. And if we don't ask questions, if we don't engage, and especially when we see something deeply going wrong, if we don't engage in that, then we're at danger as a community of further segmenting, of further isolating ourselves from each other, and we'll never come to being aware of each other and our needs.
Well, we got a lot of responses to that interview. Andrea writes, I was born and raised in Bellevue and not a stranger to racism and discrimination. I'm a second-generation Mexican-American female, and as a child, I struggled with being the only lonely in all of my classes in school. When I moved back to the area, I thought it would be different. With the growth in diversity on the East Side, thanks to Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, I figured it would be a whole new world. In fact, it was the opposite. Andrea goes on to tell the story of an incident at a PCC parking lot in Issaquah. Her dad was sitting in the car waiting for her, and a woman parked next to him hit their car with her door. Andrea's dad said under his breath she should at least apologize for hitting their car. Andrea says, I came out to the car witnessing the woman yelling at my father and telling him to go back to the country you came from, and you people are stealing our jobs. My father asked, what country do you think we're from? She said, I don't know where you Pakistani Middle East people come from. At that moment, writes Andrea, I realized how different the area has become. I was used to microaggressions and ignorant comments, but never have I been verbally assaulted and felt pure hate for people of color. I thought the new diversity would positively change the area. But after that experience, it felt as though there was resentment and anger toward the new mix of people. I think the growth of my beloved Greater Seattle area is at a critical point where we must engage empathy and concern by all residents. If people are isolated and divided, the great community feeling that Seattle had will be gone and will become just another chaotic and crowded metropolitan area. What do you think? Do you agree with Andrea? Is the Seattle area getting worse when it comes to inclusiveness, when it comes to racism, sexism? Write to us with your story, record@kuow.org. We want to keep this conversation going about how the Seattle area is changing and who is really welcome here. record@kuow.org. We're glad you're here with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now we meet two migrants who found a new life in Seattle. If you saw Nayef Harabid and Beitou Lami walking around together in their Capitol Hill neighborhood, they probably wouldn't even stand out. You would never guess they met while doing very dangerous jobs in one of the world's most dangerous places. 12 years ago, Nayef was a translator for the Marines in Iraq. Beitou was a soldier in the new Iraqi army. They met while stationed in a house in Ramadi, a city crippled by near-constant battle between allied forces and insurgent fighters. That's where the two started talking and started to fall for each other. Nayef told me what he and Beitou found to talk about in that house in Ramadi.
We was looking only for one beautiful things can let us forget where are we now and where we feeling, because you know, is arms, is we see dead people, it's fight. So what are we talking about? It's about our life and past, about how we feel, about what we like to be in the future. And that was very beautiful in that difficult moment.
Were you openly gay at the time, both of you? Did you know?
First time, no.
When you first met?
Yeah, we cannot say we are gay for each other.
Yeah.
But first
4 days, I told you, I love you. You don't answer. Just you kiss me and you leave. I'm come back in my bed. And 2 days, I'm not eat anything. Yeah. I'm so excited. But same time, this is danger. And in Iraqi, sergeant, in 15 years, you count in the...
You mean if they find us we gay in Iraqi law, it's 15 years being in jail.
Yeah.
So to be gay in Iraq, it's very dangerous. It's losing your life. You're getting ashamed to the family. The family, you lose your family and you lose your friends. You lose everything almost. So that's why there is other ways to be gay, just to be between you and yourself and maybe the other person.
How did you come to leave Iraq?
For me, I get dangerous not just because I'm gay. It's because I work with the U.S. military, which is they start writing our names in the street and I cannot meet my family anymore.
You're being targeted by Iraqis.
Targeted by the militias, by a lot of people. And all my neighborhood know I work with Americans, so they call me traitor. Yeah. And in that time, I applied for the asylum, and I get it in 2009. So in 2009, that was the most difficult time for me because I'm living alone without him.
How are you doing at that time?
I like it. I love it. He's safe. But
you like that he's safe.
Yeah, he goes safe life. Or he now told everyone on the outside, I'm gay. He welcome in United States. But me, I live in Iraq. Is now just me, and so difficult.
So in that time, I was feeling very guilty to leave him behind. We've been since we met. Till this day, we never any day passed without we talking together. By phones, by Skype, by almost everything. We use everything. He's been spending most of his money from the military to buy cards to speak with me by phones. Because when I come here first time, I was kind of broken, you know, and I have a job and I have that much money to buy the cards and call.
Yeah, he moved in United States. He just have $50.
$50.
Yeah,
in my pocket.
And Nayef, you worked for years to get B2 here to the States. First, you got him out of Iraq to Lebanon. Then from Lebanon to Vancouver, Canada. You married in Canada, but you didn't have a visa. Then it was a little more than a year ago you finally got an appointment with U.S. immigration offices in Montreal. Tell us about that day.
And that day was one of my biggest days ever. So we went there, and I was having like a bunch of paper, all my trips to him when he was in Beirut and when he was... All our pictures since 2004.
Photos, letters.
Yeah, all to prove our relationship. That time was 10 years. And the interview was only 10 minutes. She asked him a specific question about how we met, how long we'll be together, and how we connect together. And after that, she said, you've been proven for a visa to live in the United States, and blah, blah. And I say, excuse me, what did you just say? And she said, yeah. So he gave proof to... To
big surprise.
Go and I say, and I was like, do you just say that? And I start crying and scream. And he said, don't scream here. At least just go outside the building. And I was like holding my mouth like this, but cry. Like I lost myself. I lost myself like really because it's finally is happening. We could live together. I'm not just him in Vancouver or in Lebanon or in Iraq. And I have to visit and I have to speak with him. Every day by Skype, by phone, or by any device because I'm tired from this. It's the time I want to wake up, see him in front of me. And when I close my eyes, he's the last face I see.
How has your life changed since you are now living in Seattle?
So he, okay.
Yeah, now anything in the change now.
A lot of things change.
Yeah, now we have home, apartment, but...
it's like a palace for us.
Yeah.
Like a what?
Palace.
A palace. Yeah. Your apartment is like a palace.
Yes.
Yeah. Now
we have our dream wedding.
Oh, my wedding. Oh, my God. It's really a dream.
You know, we always was imagine our wedding and what are we going to say it, what are we going to do. But the wedding is just come more about what we imagine. It's because with all these friends been supporting us, all those beautiful people, we just have an amazing, beautiful day.
Yes, I love him. He loved me. We now 12 years together. I think you're more 50 or 55 years more. We together.
That is Beitou Lami. He and Nayef Harabid got married here last year. They met 12 years ago during the Iraq War while Beitou was a soldier in the Iraqi army and Nayef was a translator for the United States Marines. This is KUOW's The Record. Seattle's Intimon Theater launched its 2016 festival last month with a focus this year on African-American women playwrights. As part of her series, Art of Our City, KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces you to the festival's curator.
When she was a kid, Valerie Curtis Newton knew what it was like to be the only African-American in the room.
There's a picture of me and this club in high school, and it's me and a bunch of white girls. And then there's this picture of the softball team, and it's me and a bunch of white girls.
Decades later, some things haven't changed. Curtis Newton is a nationally respected stage director and head of the performance program at the University of Washington Drama School. But when she works with local theater companies, often she's still the only African American in the room.
Then it makes everybody nervous when I enter a space that somehow I'm just looking, you know, like a Geiger counter for latent racism that just sort of ticks off when I get near it.
Curtis Newton wasn't always into theater. Her college roommate dragged her to an audition.
I got a part. I had a little walk-on part. I played an old lady, and that was the beginning of being a part of that community.
She loves how theater weaves together artists and audience members, but Curtis Newton wants to expand that community.
I love Black people. I love our history. I love our fortitude. I love our contributions to the American fabric. And I just want to make sure that I give other people the opportunity to fall in love with us, too.
To Valerie Curtis Newton, every new relationship we forge can open our minds a little bit wider. From the University District, that's The Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
Catch a conversation between Marcy and Valerie Curtis Newton this Sunday afternoon. It's part of KUOW's Front Row Center program. You'll find out more at our website, KUOW.org. And for all of Marcy's art stories, look on social media for the hashtag Art of Our City. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A year ago at our website, KUOW.org, we published photos from the 1940s and 50s of Black people in Seattle. The people in those photos, we didn't know who they were. Well, now we do. Here's online editor Isolde Raftery.
We asked you to help us identify the people in the photos, and we got 45 responses. But there was one photo I really wanted to know about. It shows a young woman in an itsy-bitsy swimsuit waving from the back of a Cadillac. She looks radiant.
I was invited to be in the Seafair Parade as the first Black queen.
That's Jessie Grimes McCorder. She grew up in Seattle's Central District, and she attended Garfield High School.
I was one of these that if there wasn't a Black kid in something, get in it. That was the way I felt, you know, because we heard about how things were in the South and some parts of the East.
When McCorder was 17, her sister signed her up for a pageant. It was being put on by the Royal Esquires, a drinking club for Black men in Seattle.
They made you kind of prance around.
She won. She credits the swimsuit.
My sister picked it out for me. It was very, very revealing. Let's put it that way.
Winnie Mett McCorder got to be in the Seafair Parade. She was invited to sit on the back of a white Cadillac and wave at the crowd.
The Black Society in Seattle was very, very happy, I guess, to see me in the parade because they really turned out.
Today, McWhorter lives in Covington, about an hour from Seattle.
I had a good life. At 84, I think I look pretty good. Everybody says, oh, that was you that's in that picture. I said, yes, and I'm still here, only there's two of me.
In Covington, I'm Isolde Raftery, KUOW News.
Some U.S. senators want the government to study health problems in veterans exposed to burning waste. So-called burn pits were common at U.S. military outposts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Reporter Jay Price tells us this bipartisan Senate bill would pay to study the effects of breathing that smoke.
U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan burned all kinds of waste, tons of it every day at some bases. Plastic and foam dinnerware from chow halls, batteries, paint, tires, you name it. Some of it obviously pretty bad stuff if you inhaled the smoke, and that was hard to avoid.
The smell was constant. You could smell it everywhere you went.
Cindy Amon is 38 and now lives in Delaware. Early in the Iraq War, though, she was a military police officer on several bases in the Middle East. When Amon came home, she joined a civilian police force and ran 5 or 6 miles a day to stay fit. But she started having trouble breathing.
I got to the point where I definitely wasn't running anywhere close to that, and then I couldn't even walk up a flight of stairs without being short of breath.
She had to quit her job. Doctors were puzzled, but eventually, after Amon demanded a painful lung biopsy, she was diagnosed with something called constrictive bronchiolitis. Some researchers say the rare lung disease is unusually common among troops who were deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Amon thinks burn pit smoke is the main cause of her condition, combined with all kinds of other pollutants she was exposed to in the Middle East, in particular dust from the frequent sandstorms.
The particulate matter over there is so much finer than anywhere else in the world. So when you're inhaling that, our bodies aren't used to that and it can't expel it like normal. So I think it was a combination of toxins in the sand. I think it was the burn pits. I think it was a combination of everything.
Different bases burn different things, and many troops, like Amon, served in several places. And troops with different jobs would have been exposed to different toxins. What's more, the powdery moon dust in parts of southern Afghanistan was different from the airborne grit in southern Iraq, or the smog dust and fecal matter from open sewers in Kabul. All this means the researchers who are trying to understand the health issues have a lot of strands to untangle. So the Senate bill calls on the VA to start a center to address the problem and says it should have ties to an emerging scientific field called medical geology.
Medical geology is the branch of geology that helps understand impacts of the earth and earth materials like dusts, soils, rocks, on human health.
Jeff Plumley is a research geochemist and associate director of environmental health for the U.S. Geological Survey. He's among a small number of geologists who work on medical issues. Plumley and other geologists at the Geological Survey have been helping researchers at National Jewish Health in Denver study tissue from lung biopsies like the one Amon got.
A pathologist will take a look at a slice of that tissue, and then we'll get a slice, and we can identify what the minerals that are present in the lung tissue are.
The researchers at the Denver Hospital are writing up the results of the study now, and they're planning more research, like finding a way to diagnose deployment-related lung problems without painful biopsies. That could help the patients and yield better information about the nature of the problem. Tom Porter is the legislative director for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
We've got a recent member survey where 74% of those respondents report that they were exposed to burn pits and other substances in the air, and 60% of those say that they've got symptoms as a result.
Including Porter himself. He says that his 2 years serving in Kabul in the Middle East gave him asthma.
I first noticed it in Afghanistan. I was there for a year. And shortly after I arrived, I had a severe reaction in my lungs to the pollution in the air.
The IAVA was one of the backers of a law 2 years ago that directed the VA to create a registry of veterans who believe they were exposed to smoke from the pits. Nearly 75,000 have signed up, but Porter says it's crucial that more do. I'm Jay Price, reporting.
Our stories on the military and veterans are part of the American Homefront Project. It's a national collaboration with KUOW, WUNC in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and KPCC in Los Angeles. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. And in local news today, Uber says it's no longer doing business in Bremerton. The Kitsap Sun reports the company does not like the city's requirement that drivers get a $75 business license. Bremerton's city attorney calls Uber's position perplexing. The city doesn't make on-demand ride companies like Uber follow the regulations for taxi cabs, but the city attorney says, like anybody else doing business in Bremerton, Uber's independent contractors have to get a business license. Well, Uber's not buying it, and now its drivers can no longer pick up fares in Bremerton. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. In January, three teenage boys went into the jungle, the sprawling homeless encampment under I-5. They shot five people and killed two of them. The shooting created a flashpoint, and it spurred a city and state plan to clear out this homeless camp, to get people help. Well, not everybody in there wants help. Not everyone wants to leave. Last week, KUOW spoke with some of the people still living in the jungle, including Kevin Boggs. Kevin Boggs is a former heroin addict who now attends a methadone treatment clinic. And he told KUOW's Joshua McNichols that community is everything to homeless people. And the importance of community is one reason so many people were hurt during that shooting.
Now that I've been an accepted member of the community, I know exactly what I would do were that to happen again. I would, you know, without hesitation, I would jump up in front of anybody being threatened, you know. There are ways you can die, and one of them is of an overdose as a junkie. And I've had that, you know, flash in front of me a few times. The other is defending persons that your neighbor. You know, I mean, anyone that I think I live with now would not hesitate to. That's why so many people were easy to shoot. Nobody split. Nobody ran when that happened. Everybody jumped up to protect, you know themselves, their girlfriends. You know, people who knew that would be. Was coming might have run away and saved them their own skin. I mean, it takes a minute to shoot five people, but they didn't. They stayed right there. And I think instinctively, you know, homeless people need to be in a community to protect each other. And
the thing that story tells me is that the bonds that develop there through whatever circumstances. Means something, and that if you have to leave it behind,
means
you
a lot.
Something.
One of the things that methadone treatment does is it gives you the stability to take care of mistakes you've made in the past as an addict. A few of those things were, you know, criminal charges I had to deal with, misdemeanors for the most part. I was jailed for one of them by surprise for 19 days, just vanished from my place in the jungle from my tent there, not knowing what I would return to, maybe back to zero. When I got back, I had every single thing that I had owned untouched, protected by the people that I now regard as family, because of that mostly. And that's a large part of the reason why I would not hesitate to defend any of them, because they took care of me. I mean, can you imagine the terror of not even knowing if you had any place to sleep, you know, coming out of jail? And I had every damn thing I owned, including valuables that I had left there. Nobody touched a thing, and they knew I'd been gone. You know, where you been? You know, and it was, you know, being, you know, a masculine, you know, American male, I'm not allowed to get all touched unless I turn around and run away. But man, I was bawling almost. You know, I had to leave and not let anybody see. You know, my God, you guys took care of my stuff. Like, this is not what most people, I've heard a lot of opinions about how people believe we live, and that's not one of them.
Kevin Boggs lives under I-5 in the jungle, and he's telling you the meaning of community in this homeless encampment, why some people don't want to leave. Boggs talked with our growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols last week at a KUOW community event. We held it at Seattle Public Library downtown, and you can hear that whole conversation about the jungle, about homelessness. We're going to tweet out a link to that right now. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Thank you. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the news, tennis star Maria Sharapova says she's going to appeal what she calls an unfairly harsh punishment, a 2-year suspension for failing a drug test. We're going to talk more about that later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Have you ever said to a friend, hey, let's go out to eat tonight. Let's say we get some Israeli food. Well, Michael Solomonov does whenever he travels. That's partly because he's a chef. He runs the restaurant Zahav in Philadelphia, and partly because he was born in Israel. Solomonov came here to Seattle a few months ago, and one of his missions was to find Israeli cuisine in our city. So I asked him to share what he found. But first, I wanted to know, since Israel's been home to so many different people, how does he define Israeli food?
So there's a couple different facets of it. There's like the food that's being cooked in Israel right now, you know, and that is that's Arab food. That's like Jewish food, whatever that is. I say that in quotation because it's like nobody really knows what that is. But basically, Israel has got this super varied, super diverse, super rich groups of ethnicities and cultures and subsequently gastronomies. Right. So you've got people that have all immigrated back in the last couple hundred years. Called Olim. It's like returning basically to Israel after being expelled from like Babylon or whatever, like the diaspora.
Yeah.
And then you've got people that have been there forever.
Okay, so you've got the physical Israel, you've got the influences from the diaspora. So is that the main thing that makes it different from just Middle Eastern food?
100%. That's a great question, too. People all the time ask, well, isn't Israeli food just like shawarma and falafel? And there is very good shawarma and falafel. There's, you know, 20% of the country is Arab. So there's like, you know, things from the Levant, the Druze influence in the Galilee, West Bank Palestinian cooking, which is different from Gaza Palestinian cooking. And then you've got like, you know, my family came from Bulgaria, but before that, Spain. So you've got Sephardic Spanish, Balkan, they were conquered by the Ottomans, you know, so it's like turns into like Turkish. That's why like every, you know, culture in the Balkans has got stuffed grape leaves. It's
right.
Like the Ottoman, right? The Ottomans were there. They make kebab, they make kofta, all these things. And then it ends up being in Israel, right? So it's like that is one slight example of what Israeli food is.
So what is Israeli cuisine by the time it gets to Seattle? Where would I eat it? My friends and I, we don't say, hey, let's go out for Israeli.
No, you don't. That's a great question. And I think here, ironically, I ate in an Israeli restaurant this morning called Egg and Plants.
Yeah.
And I went in there not knowing what to expect because I think that a lot of people that open any ethnic restaurants, it was the same thing for Italian food like 50 years ago. It was like American Italian is not like Italian, right?
Right.
So you usually go into these places and it's like a businessman that opens a restaurant and they don't care necessarily about either the quality, the authenticity, whatever that like grandmother effect that you get from food.
Yeah.
They don't have that, which is a huge concern because that's where the magic is, right? So we go in there and I was like, man, this is so cool. There was like a chalkboard and it was like shakshuka. Do you know what that is?
No.
So that's a tomato pepper stew with eggs in it. That's popularized by Israel, but it originally came from the North African Jews in the 50s. And then right underneath it was sabich. Do you know what that is?
I do not.
It is a fried eggplant sandwich that goes inside of pita that you put amba, which is like a mango pickle on, that was actually brought to Israel by the Iraqi Jews in the 1952 or 1953. And then underneath it was definitely something you've never heard of called malawach. All
Got
sounds
me.
Like Klingon, right? I know. But malawach was a laminated flatbread brought to Israel by the Yemenite Jews. And I was like, they understand Israeli cuisine because you've got Yemeni, Iraqi, and Moroccan or North African. And it was like really, really cool. And it was delicious. We had breakfast this morning. I jogged to West Seattle from downtown and then ate some Israeli breakfast. It was awesome.
We're no Tel Aviv, but we've got a mix of influences in the Seattle area.
Of course.
Do you find, what connections, if any, do you find between Northwest cuisine and Israeli cuisine?
Well, I think that really what Israeli cuisine is about a sort of cultural heritage, the food that your sort of ancestors cooked, and what you are using locally. Right. And I was trying to like answer this question a little bit earlier in my head because I'm a nerd and I only think about these things. And we were cedar plank salmon, which is something that you guys do all the time.
Yes,
right.
We do.
Coho salmon on a cedar plank to me is very similar to kofta or like chicken shish leek cooked over charcoal. it's got the same visceral effect, right? It's something that is, in a way, indigenous to what you're doing here, using either local fuel, local technique of cooking, and local ingredients, you know? And it's almost ceremonial, right?
Yes.
Eating cedar plank salmon in Seattle is like a thing.
It's a ritual.
It's a ritual, right? So that's the general answer. But I was thinking about right now we're getting great rhubarb in the States, we're getting great rhubarb in eastern Pennsylvania, but my favorite rhubarb and berry comes from Richter Berries, which is here in Washington.
Uh-huh.
It's so good. This guy, I think it's George Richter, he makes, you know, he grows berries and he grows rhubarb, and we go crazy. We nearly bankrupt our restaurant whenever they're in season because we buy so much of it. And rhubarb is something that I love to use, and there's a Persian dish that is rhubarb that's braised with lamb and mint, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, that would make a lot of sense right now too, right? Rhubarb is in season. We get great lamb and let's do it. And I'm like, and if the rhubarb comes from Washington State and maybe you take like a little hazelnut action and you put that right on top, Is that Israeli food? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. That's how you cook Israeli food, or that's how you eat Israeli food globally.
Michael Solomonoff, James Beard Award-winning chef in Philadelphia. His restaurant and his cookbook are both named Zahav, and he talked to us about how ingredients and cooking here in the Northwest do or don't relate to Israeli cuisine. And he mentioned one place there that he finds Israeli food in Seattle. That was Eggs and Plants in Belltown. Solomonoff was in a documentary called In Search of Israeli Cuisine. We're tweeting out a link to the trailer for that right now, at KUOW. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. What do you care more about, human rights in China or the money we make by trading with China? That tension comes up every time a Chinese leader visits Seattle, right? There are dignitary welcomes and there are human rights protests. Well, that tension got more pointed last week in Ottawa and across Canada, where China's foreign minister berated a Canadian reporter at a news conference. Let's find out what happened with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, what was the reporter's offending question?
Yeah, reporter Amanda Connolly asked Wang Yi a question about China's human rights record, and particularly about the imprisonment of a Canadian missionary, Kevin Garrett, who Canada regards the charges against him as being trumped up, but he's being imprisoned nevertheless. Man, did she get a tough response. And people can go on YouTube and type in Wang Yi and Amanda Connolly and see the response, because it's right there, but here's the translation. I have to say your question is full of prejudice against China and arrogance, and I don't know where that is coming from. It is totally unacceptable. Have you been to China? Do you know China has lifted more than 600 people out of poverty? Do you know China is now the second largest economy in the world? Do you think development is possible in China without protection of human rights? You should not ask such questions in such an irresponsible manner, a groundless and irresponsible allegation, and all the while he's wagging his finger at her. So that's a pretty tough response. It's been very, very controversial here, Bill, in Canada, partly because Canada's foreign affairs minister was standing there while this went on. In fact, it was at the headquarters of Canada's Foreign Service. Our minister, Stéphane Dion, didn't say a word. He just let it go on. 2 days later said, well, I didn't think I need to jump in and protect the reporter. She's a professional. She can handle these things. Our prime minister has expressed his dissatisfaction with China on this issue, but, man, that was a pretty shocking exchange.
Yeah. Well, how has China been? You mentioned that he defended how China's lifted 600 million people out of poverty. What's the conversation about right now about to their human rights record there?
Well, their ambassador to Canada has weighed in with an opinion piece saying, you know, Canadians should be very careful what they say on these matters, that raising these human rights issues in China, we should recognize that the history is different, the cultural differences are different, and might affect a chance for a golden era in bilateral trade between the two countries. I guess the one thing I'll say about the Chinese is they're not subtle on these matters, right?
Right. They were direct.
They lecture you up front. They tell your reporters to shut up and stop asking rude questions. And then they write opinion pieces in the papers saying, if you want to have a good trading relationship with us, you better not keep bringing these issues up. It's, you know, one of the interesting things about all this, Bill, is that while Canada does have a good trading relationship and an important one with China, British Columbia sells a lot of lumber to China. We're trying to sell liquefied natural gas to them. We actually have a trade deficit. We buy more stuff from China, about $46 billion worth, than they buy from us. So I don't know who should be more worried about the relationship. You know, we buy a lot of good things from China, and they buy from us, but it is a bilateral arrangement, and at the moment, it's a trade deficit.
Is this a political argument in Canada now, how Justin Trudeau and the new Liberals are dealing with Canada?
Well, I think the reaction has been that we really shouldn't shut up about this issue, and we really should keep raising these matters. I don't think, I mean, look, the United States hasn't had much success on this issue either. I don't think it makes a hell of a lot of difference to China. They're obviously going to do their own thing on this, but our prime minister is scheduled to visit China in the fall, and our prime minister, you know, Justin Trudeau has been a bit of a Boy Scout on a lot of these issues, so I suppose you could say our government is naive in thinking that if it pushes back at this kind of outspoken comment, we might make a difference. I don't know, though, it does. I mean, you tell me, how much success has the United States had on this file? Not much, is my reading of it.
Yeah, it's de rigueur to say something that includes the phrase human rights and then kind of do what you were going to do anyway. I think that's the a view down here.
Yeah. And that's not only true with China. I mean, you know, the president of the United States is used to being lectured when he goes around the world. Look at Putin in Russia. He doesn't listen to any of this stuff. And I suppose people could point out that Canada hasn't paid a hell of a lot of attention to the rest of the world in our treatment of indigenous people, on the production of greenhouse gases from the Alberta oil sands. You know, it's interesting. I think some world leaders just kind of, you know, grin and bear it or roll their eyes, and some of them talk back. And I guess the news here is that our reporters are used to asking rude questions and maybe not getting the answers they want. They're not used to being lectured.
Yeah, that was you're right. That was a finger wagger available on YouTube. That's Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun columnist, joining us regularly. Thank you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Amnesty International, by the way, has said that though, yes, China has lifted its one-child policy, replacing it with a two-child policy, that still harassment, surveillance, house arrest, imprisonment of human rights defenders are on the rise in China, and that censorship of the internet and other media has grown. That's according to Amnesty International, and that's the view from Canada on KUOW's The Record.